Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Pax Britannica. Season 3, Episode 22. A Mountain of Gold. Welcome back to Pax Britannica. I'm your host, Dr. Samuel Hume. Before we begin today, I need to welcome our new members of the House of Lords, the Marquess of Cheshire, Ted Timmins, Dominique, Marquess of Oxford, the Earl Royal Dragoon, Shea Gurion, Earl of Dover, Viscount Trueheart, Viscount ACC, Tobias, Baron Fish, and Travis, Baron Dryden. The new Marquesses and Earls have access to the bonus content, and there's a new episode of the History of the Mughal Empire coming out in the next week or so. All patrons get their own premium RSS feed that lets them listen to the podcast without ads. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to find out more. I'd also like to thank Carla for her very generous donation. Last episode, we spent some time on the United Provinces of the Netherlands. In the wake of the Peace of Munster, the Dutch state was rocked by two constitutional events. A coup, orchestrated by the stadtholder, Willem II, Prince of Orange, which would reinforce the role of the executive in Dutch politics. And then, after successfully defeating, deposing, and arresting his enemies, at the ripe old age of 24, Willem suddenly died. With his death, the unborn William III would be denied the office of stadtholder, and the States General, the Parliament of the Netherlands, declined to elect one for more than two decades. One of the first acts of this stadtholderless Netherlands was to recognise the Commonwealth of England as a legitimate government. The Commonwealth had sent two representatives to The Hague to discuss a commercial treaty and possible union between the two Protestant republics. Instead, as we left off last time, the two republics were careering into war. Though there were similarities between the two, in some ways, that simply laid the foundations for future hostility. The repeated victories of English independence over Charles I, the Covenant of Scots, and Catholic Irish had shown to them that God was on their side. They were his instruments. Add to this the sudden, some would say providential, death of Willem II, son-in-law to Charles I. He'd been an obstacle to closer relations between the Netherlands and the English Republic, and his early death looked an awful lot like God had just taken him off the board. Providence was telling the godly to come together and take the fight to the Catholic powers of Europe. And yet, the Dutch were disinterested in sacrificing their hard-won sovereignty for a union with the English. They'd seen what happened to the Covenant of Scots. They had once been allied to the English Parliament, and now they'd been conquered by it. The provinces which made up the Netherlands were also fiercely protective of their own autonomy. In a lot of ways, the United Provinces were very similar to the United States of America, under the Articles of Confederation, before it became more centralised under the Constitution. Jan de Witt, the future Grand Pensionary of the Province of Holland, told off Dutch ambassadors for calling the United Provinces a republic, as in a singular republic. instead of a federation of republics, plural. This was not a political culture which looked longingly at the most centralized state in Europe and thought, yes, absolutely, we want some of that. In terms of foreign policy, the two republics had very different priorities. Revolutionary England had many enemies and very few friends, whereas the Dutch now had almost no enemies and wanted to stay friends with everyone. Their business was trade. As Churches and Haynesworth put it in The Anglo-Dutch Naval Wars, 1652 to 1674, not only might the giant hug them to death if they accepted its embrace, any association with it would drag the Dutch into wars in which they would lose much and could gain nothing. End quote. The repeated violations of Dutch neutrality by the seizure of goods being transported under the Dutch flag enraged Dutch opinion, and despite diplomatic efforts, the Commonwealth refused to relax the policy spelled out in the Navigation Act. The independence at the heart of the Commonwealth's government saw Dutch reluctance to join a godly union to cast down Antichrist and tyrant both as not only misguided but wicked. The growing friction between English and Dutch merchants certainly didn't help this. The Dutch, freed from the pressure of the 80 Years' War, were going from strength to strength in both European and colonial trade. Clearly the reason the Dutch were refusing to cooperate for the cause of Protestantism was because they were too interested in building material wealth, said resentful independent English merchants who actually fancied some of that material wealth. Another element, which I neglected to mention last time, was that many Dutch leaders, especially leaders from among the Amsterdam and Rotterdam merchant communities, were more high church Protestants. Arminianism, the original Laudianism. That, of course, did not go down well with English independence. And then there was the elephant in the room, Mary Stuart, the Princess Royal. Although calling her an elephant might be a bit rude. The continued presence of the Stuarts in The Hague was an added source of tension. Over the last few episodes, we've looked at the state's navy quite a bit. Today, we'll briefly look at the Dutch navy. And the first thing to note is that it isn't as simple as one Dutch navy. Because of the makeup of the United Provinces, there were five different independent admiralties. Amsterdam, in the province of Holland, was by far the largest and most influential. The Admiralty of the Maize, in neighbouring Rotterdam, also in Holland, was more senior. Holland had a third admiralty, the North Quarter Admiralty, which alternated between two ports every 6 months, because those two ports were rivals who wouldn't stand for their admiralty residing permanently anywhere else. Zeeland had its own admiralty, as did Friesland. Each of these admiralties administered themselves, and though nominally answered to a central authority, were highly autonomous. On top of these admiralties were the joint stock companies of the East India Company and the West India Company, the VOC and the WIC, respectively. Both companies had vast trading fleets, and many of their ships were heavily armed. In addition to the larger admiralties and the companies were smaller directorschappen, municipal navies which provided convoy protection, and there were also privateering fleets based out of Friesland. This was a lot of ships. There is a reason that the Dutch were seen as the chief naval power of the North Sea. But this vast fleet was divided. The decentralized nature of the navy meant that there were rivalries of all kinds, between the admiralties, between the admirals, between ships' captains, between the competing cities of Rotterdam and Amsterdam, between Orangists and Statists, between Arminians and Calvinists, between competing merchants, and between different factions and patrons and loyalties. Cooperation and coordination was not an easy sell, and that was before you touch on geography. Because of the nature of the Dutch coastline, it was no easy feat to actually gather all these ships into one place, if you could convince them all to do so. As the tension between the two countries mounted, and after the Navigation Act was passed by the Commonwealth Parliament, the States General voted to expand their official navy by 150 ships, to a total of 226. Many of these would be drafted from the merchant fleets, but others would be built. Often, the ships drafted into military service had once served in the 80 Years' War. The economic value of turning swords into plowshares had meant the slimming down of dedicated military vessels. Now they were brought back into service, They already had a reputation as the foremost naval power in Europe, and the States General expected that this grand expansion would cow the English and force them to back down. Instead, it was a massive miscalculation, because when the English saw that their neighbour was expanding their navy at a huge rate, the immediate assumption was that the Dutch were either sabre-rattling or preparing for a war. Worse, the States General had been too ambitious. The large figure could not be met quickly. Even though some existing ships would be drafted into the fleet, the rest had to be built, and that took time. The planned number of ships was enough to spook the English, but at the moment it was an empty number. Meanwhile, the English began their own preparations for war. Many Dutch leaders were confident in their naval position. They had defeated the mighty Spanish Empire, hadn't they? What naval experience did the English really have? In living memory, the Stuart Navy had suffered embarrassing fiascos at La Rochelle and Cadiz. The States Navy was larger and better led than its predecessor, but it had only put down a few rebels. It had blockaded Lisbon, but the Dutch were already winning their own war against the Portuguese Navy, so that wasn't that impressive. But quite apart from underestimating the capabilities of the States Navy, Dutch hawks were ignoring geography. Spain had had to operate far from their main ports, the Spanish Netherlands notwithstanding, whereas the Commonwealth was positioned in the path of most of the Netherlands' most profitable trade routes. Any trade with Africa, Asia, the Americas, or from the Mediterranean had to sail past English, Scottish, and Irish shores. The carrying trade west would also be cut off, and the trade with the Baltic could be threatened. If Dutch seaborne trade was threatened, then they lost their greatest financial strength. Worse, food is pretty important too, and a lot of the United Provinces' food came from the sea, either directly from fishing or from seaborne trade. Whereas the Commonwealth was largely self-sufficient, and its seaborne trade was rather small compared to the rest of its economy. To put it simply, the Commonwealth would be more insulated from a naval war with the Netherlands, and the Netherlands would be incredibly vulnerable. This was a miscalculation by both English and Dutch leaders. The Dutch believed they could protect their trade against the Commonwealth, whereas the English couldn't believe that the Dutch would risk a war when the Commonwealth had such a strategic advantage. There were Dutch leaders who saw the issues clearly, especially those from Holland who favoured peace and the continuance of trade above most other concerns. Adrian Pauw, the Grand Pensionary of Holland, was visiting England on a diplomatic mission, and described the situation like this, quote, "The English are going to attack a mountain of gold. We have to face one of iron." He saw the dominance of Dutch trade, especially trade with his native province of Holland, as a significant weakness in the Dutch position. Admiral Martin Tromp was another sceptic, and shortly before the Battle of Dover, he wrote to his political masters, warning them that in a war with the Commonwealth, all military vessels would have to be concentrated in order to face the States Navy, which would leave the Dutch merchant vessels vulnerable. The English ships were also larger and more heavily armed than their Dutch opponents, so a pure numbers advantage did not necessarily mean naval supremacy. But hawks in the States General did not agree. And with negotiations leading nowhere and tensions continuing to rise, they sent Tromp out again with orders that Roger describes as, quote, "both stiffer in tone and vaguer in meaning." We left off last time as Tromp's fleet met Blake's off the coast of Dover.
Let Mysteries at Midnight be your destination for detective whodunits and captivating mystery stories. You'll hear classic stories like Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie's Poirot, and short tales from H.G. Wells, Charles Dickens, Edgar Allan Poe, and others. I'm Christopher, and I read these classic stories in the soothing style of a bedtime story, so you can listen to them in bed when you drift off to sleep. I also host the number one sleep podcast in the world called Sleep Cove, where millions drift off to meditations, hypnosis, and bedtime stories. We soon realized that listeners wanted to hear our mystery stories all in one place. So we created Mysteries at Midnight, where you can listen to all new tales every week. Search for Mysteries at Midnight on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app, and follow and subscribe so you don't miss out on new episodes. So why don't you pick a story now? And can you guess the twist?
Was the Sphinx 10,000 years old?
Were there serial killers in ancient Greece and Rome?
What were the lives of transgender, intersex, and non-binary people like in the ancient world?
We're Jen.
And Jenny.
From Ancient History Fangirl. We tell you true stories and tall tales of the ancient world. Sometimes we do it tipsy. Sometimes we have amazing guests on our show. Historians like Barry Strauss, podcasters like Liv Albert, Mike Duncan, and authors like Joanne Harris and Ben Aronovich.
We take you to the top of Hadrian's Wall to watch the Roman Empire fall at the end of the world.
We walk the catacombs beneath the Temple of the Feathered Serpent under Teotihuacan.
We walk the sacred spirals of the Nazca Lines in search of ancient secrets.
And we explore mythology from ancient cultures around the world.
Come find us at AncientHistoryFangirl.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
It was a pleasant day in May 1652. Anthony Young, captain of the state's navy ship, the President, was en route to Plymouth to join the Western Guard. Here, they would protect the Western approaches to the Commonwealth of England. Along with the President were the Nightingale and the Recovery, and they reached the headland of Start Point, jutting out of Devon into the English Channel. As they cleared the headland, they saw sails on the horizon. 10 ships in total. Was this the fleet of Sir George Ayscue, returning in triumph from his suppression of Barbados? He was due back any day now, after all, and it would be welcome news to report to London. As the ships drew closer, Young and his officers saw that the ships weren't flying the cross and harp of the Commonwealth, but the tricolour flag of the United Provinces of the Netherlands. It was a Dutch convoy of 7 merchantmen guarded by 3 men of war, carrying valuable goods from the Mediterranean, led by Commodore Hoyloot. After months of growing tensions, officers on both sides had been given strict rules of engagement. Young had been ordered to assert the traditional claim of the English state, the English sovereignty of the seas, and insist that Dutch ships lower their flags in salute. The Commodore had been told not to do so. The 2 flotillas were at a standoff when Young sent a small boat to ask if the Dutch would kindly salute the English sovereignty. Despite his orders, probably more interested in shepherding the merchant ships home, the Commodore agreed. The cannons were fired in salute, the flag was lowered, and that was that. Except it wasn't. One of the subordinate captains, Captain Joris van der Zanen, commanded one of the other men of war, and he replied to Young's messenger that the English captain could come over and lower it himself if he thought he could. Young responded to the challenge by firing a broadside at van der Zanen's ship. Van der Zanen fired one back. Soon everyone was firing in a confused melee which lasted 1.5 hours. By the end, at least 1 English sailor had been killed, 4 more were wounded, and the President had been damaged. But van der Zanen finally relented, struck his flag, and made the required salute. He would not, however, agree to Young's demand to surrender his ship to answer for the damage. Young was advised by his fellow captains to let it go for the sake of peace, and the 2 flotillas parted ways. Young immediately reported the engagement once he reached Plymouth, unsure how his actions would be perceived in London. Had he gone too far? Had he not gone far enough? The Council of State responded to him on the 17th of May, telling Young that they were, quote, very well satisfied. This skirmish seems to have been forgotten in most tellings of the First Anglo-Dutch War, possibly because it was soon overshadowed. As the Council of State was replying to Young, a flotilla of 9 English warships, commanded by Nehemiah Bourne, were anchored behind the Goodwin Sands, a sandbank to the northeast of Dover. Around 1 p.m, lookouts spotted a large Dutch fleet of 41 men of war, sailing south from the Downs and towards Dover. This fleet was commanded by Lieutenant Admiral of the United Provinces, Martin Tromp. He'd been anchored off Newport, just to the east of Dunkirk, but a strong wind forced him to sail his fleet across the English Channel to shelter there. He sent two of his ships to meet with Bourne, and the captains politely explained why they were there. Bourne was civil, but as soon as they returned to their ships, he prepared for the worst. He sent a ketch, a small but fast ship, to the west of Dover, where Admiral Robert Blake was positioned with 13 ships. Bourne also had his crews prepare to weigh anchor, to run, as soon as the Dutch showed any hostility. Meanwhile, with the wind died down but night falling, Tromp anchored his fleet off the coast of Dover. Throughout all of this, none of the Dutch ships had lowered their flags or saluted the English vessels. Tromp had been ordered not to do so unless it was clear that the English posed a threat. He chose to interpret those orders very strictly. The garrison at Dover Castle watched suspiciously on. The boom of a single cannon shot made their displeasure at this disrespect known. Overnight, Blake sailed towards Dover against a strong wind. He had sent Bourne's ketch back with orders to rendezvous. Now came a series of misunderstandings and errors, born from pride and miscommunication. With daylight, Tromp could now see the slowly approaching fleet of Blake, and he decided to leave. As Tromp prepared to weigh anchor, he had his men practice firing their muskets. The gunshots echoed across the water, which did nothing to reduce the tension. Bourne received his orders from Blake by about 10 a.m, but he was still behind the Goodwin Sands. By the time he'd got around them, at about noon, Tromp had already begun to move. Tromp's destination was France, where the cargo he was escorting was originally bound. He was about halfway there when lookouts spotted another Dutch ship sailing towards them. The ship looked battle-damaged, and its captain had been desperately seeking out Tromp for days. This ship was commanded by van der Zanen. He'd left the bulk of the flotilla sheltering off the English coast in the aftermath of last week's battle, and he came to Tromp to request his help. Van der Zanen informed Tromp that when he left, he had seen a large English fleet nearby, and both men suspected that by now the flotilla was being searched for quote-unquote contraband. Considering the value of the cargo, worth 50 tons of gold by Tromp's reckoning, the perfidious English would surely claim it was violating Commonwealth law and take it for themselves. Tromp turned his fleet around, determined to prevent this violation of Dutch maritime rights. In fact, the fleet van der Zanen had spotted was Blake's, and Blake had ignored the Dutch flotilla. They were clearly sheltering, not trading, and so he left them undisturbed. But now he saw Tromp's larger fleet suddenly stop, turn around, and come right at him. He ordered his fleet to prepare for battle. His fleet formed up, with Blake's flagship, the James, at the front, and its speed was reduced to allow Bourne to catch up. By 4:30 p.m, Tromp's flagship, the Brederode, likewise at the front of the formation, and by far the largest ship in the Dutch Navy, was within musket range of Blake. What exactly happened next is unclear, because both Blake and Tromp reported different stories to their superiors. Tromp would later insist that he had no violent intentions and was simply attempting to pass the English fleet to collect the flotilla. Blake, meanwhile, had seen nothing but belligerence from the Dutch for the last 24 hours. In his eyes, Tromp was clearly trying to start a fight. He had brazenly anchored right off the English coast. Now he was sailing a large fleet right at him, and throughout it all, he had not once recognised the English sovereignty of the seas. Both sides were expecting a fight, so it didn't take much for one to start. In Blake's telling, as Tromp's armada bore down on him, Blake ordered a warning shot. This was a clear message: strike your flag. Not only would this acknowledge the English claim, but it would show that the Dutch had no violent intentions. Tromp ordered no such thing. Blake fired a second warning shot, and this time Tromp replied with a signal gun, acknowledging the warning, but not striking the flag. Blake fired a third warning shot, and the Dutch responded with a full broadside of cannon fire right into the English fleet. With the first punch thrown, Blake replied with his own broadside, and the Battle of Dover was on. Tromp would later publish a defence of his actions, and in this, the English fleet was so disorganised, he couldn't work out if any of them were captured Dutch ships. Blake's third warning shot maimed one of Tromp's crew, obliterating the man's arm, and it was Blake who fired the first broadside, not Tromp. Most historians, although not all, put the blame primarily on Blake. In part, this is because, to quote Hainsworth and Churches, Tromp knew that his masters feared war but hoped to avoid it, unlike the English commanders who expected war and knew that their masters were inclined to embrace it. End quote. Even with the late arrival of Bourne's ships, the English were heavily outnumbered in the Battle of Dover. Tromp commanded 41 men of war, whereas Blake led about 22 ships. Despite the numbers advantage, the English ships were bigger and had more guns. The fight became a general melee, starting around 4:30 and only ending as the sun set and the Dutch pulled back. It was only once the two fleets were out of range that firing stopped. The States Navy had had the best of it. The Dutch lost two ships, both captured in boarding actions. The crews were taken prisoner and the ships taken as prizes. The English didn't lose a single ship, unless you count one of the captured prize ships. Convinced the vessel was going to sink from damage, the English crew abandoned it, and it floated away, right into the path of Tromp's fleet, who skillfully salvaged it and took it back. Though the number of lost ships is tiny, there were significant numbers of crew killed or wounded. It was a messy fight, started by mutual confusion, distrust, and national pride, and it effectively started the First Anglo-Dutch War. The Dutch were conciliatory, still eager to avoid outright conflict. What could war really bring them that they didn't already have? At best, a victory over the Commonwealth could enforce their respect of Dutch neutrality and the abolition of the Navigation Act. But in return for these minor benefits, they'd fight a war that, even if they won, would damage Dutch trade. Grand Pensionary Powell was again sent to London to try and negotiate. There was little he could offer. Public opinion in the Netherlands was against offering concessions or showing weakness of any kind. For their part, the English were outraged. From their perspective, this was just the latest in a long line of insults and acts of aggression. In that sense, if the spark of war hadn't come from the Battle of Dover, it would be from some other cause, and there were many more skirmishes and seizures of Dutch shipping over the following weeks. Many Commonwealth leaders, politicians and naval officers saw the naval build-up ordered by the States General as a ticking time bomb. Better for a war to start now than in a year's time, when the Dutch position may have been stronger. Diplomatic efforts came to nothing. On the 8th of July, 1652, the Commonwealth Parliament officially declared war on the United Provinces of the Netherlands. The declaration described how the Dutch had villainously attacked both Young and Blake's fleets, completely unprovoked, and how the Commonwealth had, quote, laboured for the friendship of the United Provinces. How carefully they had avoided all differences and occasions of a war between the nations, though all such overtures of amity and nearest alliance had been rejected. At last, when this Commonwealth was assaulted and invaded, their ships torn, their men slain, without the least colour of any offence given, not only the rights, honour and traffic, but even the very being of this Commonwealth had been highly endangered. The Parliament held it their duty, thus compelled and necessitated, into a most unwelcome war begun upon them to defend themselves. And whilst a just satisfaction and security cannot otherwise be had, to endeavour the gaining thereof by such ways and means wherewith the Lord shall enable them. End quote. Next week we will cover the early stages of the First Anglo-Dutch War, as some of the busiest shipping lanes in the world become battlefields. Thank you to my House of Lords, the King's favourite Mike Sanders, the Duke of Ormond, Brendan Bonner, the Marquess of Ludlow, Nick Robinson, and the Countess of Clarendon, Mandy Wright. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to join their ranks and listen to the podcast without ads. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, or if you are feeling especially generous, there's a donation link in the episode description. For other great podcasts on the Airwave Network, such as Historical Blindness, check out airwavemedia.com. Thank you to Sounds Like an Earful for the interval music in today's episode, to my entire House of Lords, and to you for listening.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. My name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.